emanating out into the deep, dark night. From Main Street in Marysville, Ohio, it's the Grand Dark Conspiracy. I'm your host, Daniel Bouts. It's my pleasure and honor to be bringing you this program here tonight on WQTT 1270 AM, streaming online at qt1270.com. I am very excited about tonight's show, and I hope that you all are as well. We're going to be talking about Rebel Angels in Exile with the author of the book, Timothy Wiley. He's been a guest on the Grand Dark Conspiracy several times in the past, and it's always a very interesting conversation, to say the least, when this gentleman has joined us on the program. I always look forward to it whenever he has a book coming out, having the opportunity to speak with him, because he has a very, very different perspective than a lot of people are aware of out there about the nature of the universe. And a lot of it comes back to him discovering the Urantia text. And we'll have him describe that a little bit when he comes on the program. But this is a very different way to look at the universe at large. It's very complicated, very complex. It's a very interesting cosmology. And it's very, let's say this, to people who are used to the conventions that we have, it's a very off-putting idea. And like I said, we'll have Timothy address these. But he has put together a book here that is very interesting. It's part history of the angel, the fallen rebel angel that he has been in communication with for several years now, and part of his history as well, how this all kind of came to be. This book is a very interesting look at a lot of different things. And like I said, we'll have Timothy on here in a little bit, and we'll get a little more in depth with him just about the process and how he put together this book and what it all means to all of us out there. If you're interested in finding out more about Timothy, his website is timothywiley.com. That's TimothyWiley.com. And the book that we're going to be talking about tonight is Rebel Angels in Exile, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the Spiritual Quickening of Humanity. And this book is a Rebel Angels Revelations on the Angelic Quarantine after the Lucifer Rebellion 203,000 years ago. So this is going to be exploring Earth's ancient history as well as looking towards the future for us, because one of the main claims in this book is that the planet Earth has been quarantined from contact from other entities in the multiverse after this rebellion, and that quarantine has been lifted. So we're looking to see a major paradigm shift in consciousness and in humanity and how we exist in the universe at large. So this is going to be a very interesting conversation, to say the least. That's what we've got going on tonight. Of course, tomorrow night we're going to be doing Darkest Hours with myself and Dave Considine. You'll have the opportunity to call in and share your ideas and thoughts with all of us out here on the radio. You can do that by calling the hotline, 877-609-9445. That's the hotline here. I'll be giving that number out, of course, more tomorrow night when we are live. And we'll be talking about a lot of interesting things. We got a lot of fantastic shows lined up for you coming up in the coming weeks. We've got a couple cool Christmas shows that we just booked today. One is looking at kind of weird Christmas stories and odd things from Christmas, and the other's going to be looking at the direct Christmas history. So we'll have a couple of great guests lined up for you that as well. And to bring in the new year, and we just got this hammered out, we'll be having Dr. Brian Parsons on to kind of relate the kind of year that has passed in paranormal. So we'll be looking at some of the top paranormal news stories, the top paranormal events of 2014 with Dr. Brian D. Parsons on the 1st. And then on the 2nd, it will be myself. That'll be that Friday. We, myself, Dave Considine, and Dr. Brian D. Parsons having a roundtable discussion about paranormal topics and what to look forward to in the coming year, which is 2015. So those are some exciting things that we have just kind of hammered down. We've got a lot of course, interesting topics just coming, just going to keep coming and coming and coming. With a lot of different types of things to cover. We got a lot of coals in a lot of irons in the coals, so to speak. And we'll be bringing you that. And you want to keep up to date with all of that, you can go to any of our social media outlets and join up there. And that's where we're going to be sending out the late breaking news in regards to the Grand Dark Conspiracy. That is one way that you can be a conspirator with us. Of course, all those links are up at granddarkconspiracy.com. You can link up to that by just going to the website and clicking on any of those links. We got Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Real quick here, Facebook is facebook.com/granddarkconspiracy. Our Twitter handle is @GDCfeed, and the Pinterest account is GDCradio, and the Instagram is granddark_conspiracy. So those are all the ways you can get involved in the conspiracy. Of course, if you're hearing my voice, we do have a chat room open for listeners to kind of get in and discuss what's going on in the show. And in the past, it's been a really nice outlet for a lot of listeners to kind of share ideas about what's going on in the show and just get to know each other. And it becomes kind of like a coming together of friends, a gathering of friends on a nightly basis. So if you're listening to the show live, you can go to the Grand Dark Conspiracy, click on the Listen Live button, and you'll be able to open the feed there and enjoy yourself in the chat room. Of course, I'm in there monitoring as well. So tomorrow night, Darkest Hours with myself and Dave Considine, and I believe we're having the guest on. We're going to have a horror author on the air with us, and you just have to tune in tomorrow night when we discuss the topic of horror with that individual as well, and you'll be able to call in and weigh in on that one yourself, or just share anything you like tomorrow night. But tonight, very excited, very, very excited to be bringing you Timothy Wiley. We're going to have a fantastic show, and I'm going to go ahead and take our first break here. And when we come back, we'll have Timothy Wiley on the line with us, and we'll be talking about rebel angels and exiles, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the spiritual quickening of humanity.
A long time ago in Bethlehem, so the Holy Bible says, Mary's boy child, Jesus Christ, was born on Christmas Day. Shepherds watched their flocks by night. They saw a bright new shining star and heard a choir from heaven sing. The music came from afar.
This is Ian.
And I'm Doc.
You can listen to us every weekday morning from 6 until 9.
Right here on True Oldies QT 1270.
Far from the city, where the Lorax roams free, is the home of the magical truffula trees. In a place you will love, with things you'll adore us, it's a magical spot. We call it the forest.
Everyone here needs the trees.
And who are you?
I'm the Lorax,
guardian of the forest.
The forest is there for you to explore. So come once to see it, then come back lots more.
I just like hearing you say it.
Visit discovertheforest.org, brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
After thousands of years, after crippling millions of children, polio will soon be stopped forever. All over the world, people are joining the men and women of Rotary to end polio now. People like Jackie Chan and Jane Goodall.
We are this close.
This close.
People like Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
This close.
People like you. Be a part of history. Help Rotary end polio now at rotary.org/endpolio. We are this close.
Maybe it's time to take a fresh look at everything we thought we knew about landing a great job. For instance, perhaps great careers start at the middle school science fair instead of at the job fair. Because the fact is, the jobs of the future will be heavily geared towards science, technology, engineering, and math. In other words, STEM. So if you're a student, talk to your school counselor about STEM. If you're a parent, talk to your kids. A public service message from America's Navy.
On my first patrol, my adrenaline was pumping.
Always on high alert. After a while, it takes a toll. I was counting the days till I came home to my family. Finally, a day arrived.
But then I realized things were different.
I had trouble focusing and relating to things the way I used to. I decided to reach out.
Once I started making connections, things began to turn around.
Find resources and support at maketheconnection.net.
Make the connection.
At 4:15 p.m. at an office in Michigan, Angie Hicks is not at her desk. She's giving blood at the company blood drive.
At the same time in the same office, Kevin Meehan is not at his desk. He's at the doctor. Kevin has cancer and needs another round of chemo.
Kevin will need blood to fight his cancer.
Angie's blood will help him win.
When you give blood to the American Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to schedule your appointment to give blood.
Wondering how you can learn about computers and how the internet can improve your daily life? The world's a lot larger with broadband. The Every Citizen Online program offers free local training. Learn how to use broadband service at your local library. It's faster than dial-up. It's easier than you think. Call 1-855-NOW-I-CAN to enroll. Get connected. Life is better with broadband.
Sponsored by Connect Ohio and aired by the OAB and this station.
Ranger Station.
Hi, I want to report a bear sighting.
Location?
My front door. It was Smokey Bear. My husband was burning leaves in the yard. He just came inside for a second.
Never leave a fire unattended. If it's too hot to touch, it's too hot to leave.
Smokey said that too.
We go way back. I knew him when he was just a cub.
How cute.
If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
From Two Oldies, 1270 WQTT, here is your Marysville area weatherbug forecast. For the rest of the morning, there's a chance of freezing rain and sleet. It'll be cloudy, a low 32. No accumulations are expected. We'll have rain Friday afternoon as we wrap up the week with a high 42. Rain continues Friday night with a low of around 40. We'll have more rain Saturday morning. Our afternoon high should be 41 with winds over 15 miles an hour. Sunday as we wrap up the weekend, we'll have a mostly sunny day. Our high 41. For True Oldies, 1270, I'm Rod Tanner.
And we're back. We have Timothy Wiley on the line with us. Welcome back to the Grand Dark Conspiracy, Timothy. It's a pleasure to have you on, and I'm excited to be talking with you again tonight. I hope that you've been well since the last time we spoke, and it appears to me that you put together a fantastic book, and it's been an absolute pleasure to read it. Welcome back, Timothy. Absolutely happy to have you on the air with us.
Well, thank you so much, Daniel. Yes, it's a real pleasure to be back with you again. I remember last time, and we had a really good and intelligent discussion. And I'm glad you like the new book. Actually, funny enough, I haven't actually seen it yet. It's got hung up in the mail, I think, but I know it pretty well.
So I actually got a copy before you did. That just doesn't seem fair, Timothy.
Does it?
No, it doesn't at all. It's beautiful, just like the previous ones, though. And again, I do compliment you on the artwork that you have included, the plates that you have inserted in the middle here. And I think I once again encourage all the listeners to go out to your website, timothywiley.com, and check out, because I know you have artwork out there as well for people to kind of check out what you have put together as an artist. But we're here to talk about Rebel Angels in Exile. And a few things, I think, before we start off. I have a new home here. I've got new listeners, and they might not be as familiar with you as a lot of the old listeners are. So I kind of, unfortunately, want to kind of tread on some old ground that we've already covered relatively quickly. I think people would be interested in kind of understanding, one, how it was that you came in contact with Georgia, and, you know, maybe if you could describe who Georgia is to you as well.
Yes, certainly. Well, actually, she first came in contact with me when I was 2 years old, which I didn't know until, 40 years later. But that was my first encounter with her, where I was born in London in the war, in the beginning of the war. So my first kind of memories are of kind of bombs dropping on me and everything like that. But of course, 2 years old is very young, and I must have been absolutely terrified, because the best I can work out at this point, and what I've been told now for my work with the angels, is that I was I was so terrified I would sort of pop out of my little body. And this particular angel, Georgia, who I've now very much got in contact with, would comfort me and take care of me when I was in that state. Now, I mean, that's very interesting in its own right, and it suggests how intimate our lives are with the angels. But, of course, in a sense, we don't know that. We have to kind of learn that through direct experience, I think, more than anything. So that was my first kind of experience. Anyway, I had a fairly sort of normal English childhood, rather unpleasant public schools and things like that. I think I should leap forward quickly until I was in my early 30s when I had a near-death experience and a real one of those, absolutely 100% extraordinary situations of being lofted out of my body, and I was very, very sick. I'm pretty sure I was dying. I didn't go to a hospital or anything, but I had walking pneumonia, and I was sort of plucked out of my body and told by a being of light. I had a whole series of adventures which I've written about in my books enough. But anyway, I was told by a being of light that I had accomplished what I had come to do, which is in itself, again, another very interesting concept, that we have something we specifically we come to do. And that they were giving me the choice. I could either continue or I could come back. And it was so magnificent, so wonderful out there that the idea of continuing, I just knew it would go on getting better and better. But I didn't know what would happen if I came back. I knew it would be amazing, but I had no idea what would happen. So, in a sense, it was my curiosity which got me back. So, anyway, back in my body, and then I kind of a new life started, I guess. It took about 6 or 7 years to really assimilate the experience, because it was so profound. And I was healed of, the thing that was ailing me, And I was shown around various places, which I was told I wouldn't remember. But I have a sense that it was probably somewhere, you know, they're quite heavenly, actually. That's all I remember. She's absolutely wonderful. Anyway, after that, I kind of started, of course, you know, being out there and meeting angels and seeing angels and being healed by entities out there. It kind of gives one a new slant on life. And it did, as I say, it took about 6 or 7 years to sort of rejig my life so I could start really kind of getting very, very involved in what I came to call non-human intelligences. Angels, of course, dolphins, which I was at my avenue into that, because I discovered that, as other people have when they have been close to dolphins, in a basically in a natural state, I would say, rather than in one of those more conditioned situations, but out in the wild, that they're highly intelligent, very different intelligent than ours, very highly intelligent, and equally telepathic. Not completely telepathic, they can't read your mind or anything like that, but one can communicate by very strong images. They seem to be able to pick up images from each other. There are all sorts of ways of accounting for this. They're very, because they live their life in water, which is very much more of a conductive medium, they're very much more sort of easily understandable, I think, of wave functions, wave forms, and like that. So anyway, they're very, very skilled. So that kind of was my introduction into sort of the tactical side of non-human intelligences. And then I had a series of experiences with extraterrestrial entities, including one in which I was able to learn quite a lot about how the universe works. So this was kind of getting really very interesting in my life. And I got very interested in working with angels, in contacting my own guardian angels, my companion angels. That led to writing books about angels, which became quite successful back in the 80s and 90s. But all this was really leading to what has been happening now the last sort of 5 or 6 years. And the book that you have in your hand, Daniel, is kind of, you know, one of the products of this. And this is this angel who contacted me and apparently has been with me for a number of my prior incarnations, and so knows me pretty well. And she claims to be a rebel angel, a fallen angel, one of the angels who identified with Lucifer at the time of the rebellion among the angels, which is, of course, a whole other story. But it happened about 200,000 years ago, over 200,000 years ago, on the inner levels, on the inner planes, not on the outer planes of the extraterrestrials, but on the inner planes of the angels. And this really radically affected our planet and another 36 planets in this particular system of planets. And we became isolated as a consequence of this. On normal planets, you know, extraterrestrials come and go, and everyone's aware of their angels. And, you know, it's all a fairly placid affair. But this planet and these other 36 other planets have been isolated and really cut off from the sort of space routes, from sort of knowledge of extraterrestrials and familiarity with angels. And it has led to, you know, well, the situation we now find ourselves in, where we really all have to work stuff out for ourselves and kind of get through that. So I think the part of the process, you know, to kind of paraphrase my life, if you like, is getting rid of the crud, getting rid of all the impossibility, getting rid of all the negative things one picks up in life, so one can actually act as a natural person. And in a natural form, of course, we're completely open and available to our angels, and they to us. And so it becomes much more of a sort of a mutual adventure, a collaborative affair, if you like. So anyway, I was approached by this angel, Georgia. I've come to call Georgia. I don't know what she really called, but I call her Georgia. More as a sort of a bit of a poke at my father, who's called George. But anyway. So she came to me basically saying, listen, I would like to go through the 500,000 years that I've been here, and I would like to examine what went wrong. I would like to see everything. And I would like to work with you to work it out. Now, this was something that was very interesting to me. I had wanted to do something along those lines anyway. So I said, yeah, okay, I'm very interested, but why don't we make a bargain? Just to keep me interested, why don't you, who's been with me for all these incarnations, so you tell me, and with me with this, my most recent incarnation, why don't you write my biography from your point of view? You tell me what happened in my life that I didn't notice, that I didn't see, all the various different influences and impacts, and all the various different angels. I mean, when I was 17, I learned that I was pulled out of a crashing car by a couple of angels, my girlfriend and I. I pulled out of an impossible car, a Chevron de Chevaux. And anyone who knows a Chevron de Chevaux will know that those tiny little flap windows, you can't get a person out of those. Anyway, half pancaked, and there with my girlfriend on one side and me on the other, lying in a sort of bewildered unconsciousness, come back and had no idea that we'd been saved by angels, of course, until 30 or 40 years later when I started talking to them. So that's a very brief, and rather exhausting tracy of a long and rather strange life.
Well, you know, and that is something that, you know, a few things that I think if we could just get out of the way and address, we can start to really kind of get into it, because I thought that was very fascinating about the book, and you mentioned it, is it's there's a history of Georgia and, you know, how they moved through the rebellion and how they dealt, how Georgia dealt with a lot of the principalities and the hierarchy and the different angels that, you know, ruled over. But, you know, when you say that, you know, that Georgia is a rebel angel that sided with Lucifer in the rebellion 203,000 years ago, for a lot of people, and I know you have to be very well aware of this, for a lot of people that's going to throw up red flags, and they're going to be like, wait, you know, you're talking to an angel, a fallen angel, you know, that has sided with Lucifer. There's no way that this could be a positive or benevolent angel, that you're dealing with a demonic entity. I mean, what is the response to that? So when people thinking that thought, what is your answer to that, so we can just kind of move beyond that?
Sure. No, I absolutely understand. And in fact, when it first came upon me, I was very frightened for exactly that reason. I didn't know what I was getting into. Now, the other side of that is that I feel now in retrospect that I was extremely well trained to be able to keep my cool in that situation. I had started reading, for instance, the Urantia book, which casts a whole different view on the rebellion. You know, usually it's called the war in heaven, you know, among most cosmologists, but the Urantia book has a very precise understanding of it because it was channeled from the angelic realms. So I was able to sort of, get out of the idea of being terrified by these beings and understand, well, you know, they were essentially politicians, you know, who wanted a particular kind of openness. It's actually quite familiar to us in this age. It's a very stern, a very organized bureaucracy, if you like, that organizes and plans out all these millions and millions of inhabited planets where they literally grow human beings. They grow mortal beings, you know, and up we go. So this is occurring on basically all these planets, and, you know, mortals in different, slightly different shapes and different forms, who are all part of basically one family, if you like. And I was pretty frightened to start with. And we had a lot of, I think it took me, 5 years probably, I think. Overall, 15 years, but 5 years to be able to sort of organize a situation where we were able to dialogue, and we made a bargain that I would always be there. I would always be in control. This was never going to be one of the situations where I would leave my body and she would speak through me or anything like that. It was always going to be a collaborative affair. And she always gave me the power, you know, if I felt she was coming on too strong, I would say enough, you know. And she would back off. So, you know, after 5 or 10 or 15 years of this kind of behavior, and really getting to know her and getting to know how anguished she was by the decision she was making and how she was trying to redeem and understand errors made, you know, thousands of years ago. I came to take her seriously. And, of course, you know, from a psychological point of view, who knows, you know, projections, multiple personalities. I've now written 8 books with her, 3 of which have now been published, with the 4th being published next year. And people seem to appreciate them. I certainly appreciate them. I never know what she's going to say next. And, you know, she works with me. I mean, it's not a question of sort of shutting my eyes and tapping out what she says to me. She comes up with a few words or a concept, and we discuss it. We think about how best to put it. And then she says, "Oh, go and do a bit of research on this." You know, I can't remember that. She can't be everywhere at once, of course. But she has a pretty good idea of what went on over the last half a million years.
So, I mean, the answer for people who assume that, you know, you're dealing with something that is evil as opposed to something that is, I guess we begin to strip away from this vantage point, we begin to kind of strip away the free will, the ability to choose one path or another, the ability to kind of have that remorse, because that is something that comes across in the book, is that, you know, George is not exactly happy with the choice they made, the alignment that she made, and the quarantine that happened because of it, and things like that, as far as when you start to look at the cosmology that is laid out here in this book, and the other books as well, it strikes me as something that is extremely complicated, and it does kind of smack of politics, as you said. It's not quite as simple or black and white in this viewpoint as a lot of people would like it to be otherwise.
Yes, no, of course, you're absolutely right. And, you know, whenever you get bunches of people or angels or any sentient beings together, I'm sure dolphins have that political situations. I don't know them particularly well. I don't know how they organize themselves. But I do know that, you know, any, you know, really sentient being, they cluster together and happily form some sort of political system. Has to. Or else does one organize oneself? But you see, from part of my training was to really understand that we're all basically on the path of redemption. Even in our own little lives, we seek, you know, we make mistakes as we grow up. We make mistakes as adults as well. We have to make mistakes before we get it right. If you get it right first time, you don't learn anything. But if you have to get it wrong, you go, then you get it right. So, of course, you know, we have made a lot of mistakes in our lives. And as we become more conscious and more aware, and we dig deeply into our lives, you know, we can start to sort of review these situations and basically clean them out, you know, get rid of the stuff that's hanging around in me, the ether of hanging around in me, subtle energy bodies, which are great. I mean, the clarity of a subtle energy body is the most important thing in terms of contact with angels. Most of us have really very, very confused emotional bodies, right? And a lot of what the human journey is about is mastering our emotional bodies, being able to really be open to love and not have to react with fear or with loathing or with anger to the situation. So I go back, I mean, I just go back to the basic Christian ethos, which is love your enemy. You know, it's very central, and much of sort of Christianity, I think, has kind of completely forgotten that. Our enemies are attempting to redeem themselves just as we are. So I think loving them is probably giving him a hand, you know?
Well, you know, that's the thing. For a lot of people, that is I think when you talk about Christianity, that is one of the hardest concepts for someone to grasp, is to love your enemy. And, you know, and it's hard because you sit there and the word enemy clearly illustrates that, you know, you're in opposition to. But that doesn't mean that you, like you said, we're all kind of struggling for that redemption. And we need to realize that, you know, for whatever reason, even though we're in opposition to these people or entities or whatever it is, that our empathy and compassion is necessary in our interaction with them. And if we were all to kind of strive that way, then maybe we would have less enemies, and maybe the need for redemption would decrease as well.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. And I think that it is very much, our soul's journey basically is to, is to move through the darkness. I mean, we can't get out of the fact that, we're living on a very dark world. And I think it was Nietzsche who said, when you find yourself in hell, keep going. And it's probably very wise advice. You just have to, really keep going with your eyes open and with an open heart, not to end every situation with suspicion. You know, one's going to get beaten around every once in a while, but it's worth it to be open and to be honest, because there's a whole wonderful universe out there. I mean, I've been living with angels now for probably 25 or 30 years in a conscious way, and I mean, it is so much. It's given so much to my life. I really have no words, really, except an intense gratitude for being able to function in this way. I mean, grateful.
So, I mean, when dealing with angels on a regular basis, this is one of the things that always amazes me when we talk, Timothy, is that constant contact with angels, and, you know, what exactly that means and how that interface occurs. And one of the things that, you hear people say, you talk about with your car accident, like people in intense stress situations tend to have contact with angels. And, this is the situation, this in this extreme traumatic situation. What is it about those that allows people to kind of have that interaction? Is it because the angels themselves kind of are forcing themselves into our wavelength, kind of to interact with us?
No. Let's get the idea of forcing out of the way. An angel would be the last being to force herself into one's life. I didn't mean to correct you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be rude. But it's actually quite interesting, because, I mean, the angels are with us all the time, but they're not here to live our lives for us. In fact, it's very important that we live our lives for ourselves. Now, when one starts getting the idea of, my goodness, the angels are real, they are real entities rather like us, and they do care very much for us, and they are our sort of guides and mentors in many ways, then one starts a whole process of beginning to sort of learn how to. It took me 2 years basically to move through this process of learning how to be with them, how to dialogue with them. And, I'm not the first person in history to be able to do this. Obviously, it's, quite common in some of the rather more ancient theologies. But in terms of why do they appear in these extreme situations, it's essentially because that's when they're really needed. In most of the cases, where people survive car crashes and things like that, and they have some sort of idea that the angels were involved, or saw an angel, or felt an angel, the conviction that an angel must have done it. That's one thing. But let me tell you a very brief story I heard when I was doing some radio work down in, Florida, I think, about 20 years ago. And I had a telephone call from somebody who was the captain of a tugboat, right, working. And he was pulling a barge of some sort, 20 or 30 people on it. And a storm came up the tugboats, the thing that joined them snapped. But what didn't snap was the radio contact. And he was sobbing basically on the phone. He was telling us this. He said that he could hear everybody screaming as the thing sunk that they were towing. And then suddenly the screaming would turn into absolute moans of awe, and he could hear people say, "My God, look at the angels are all around us, the angels are all around us," and then that was it, you know, and the thing sunk. And I mean, this is a hardened guy. It's not somebody who is, you know, hallucinating or anything like that. This is a very real experience that happened to him. And of course it happens probably on less cultured societies than ours, probably more often because there's less to get in the way, there's less rationalization, there's less, "Oh, that must have been a trick of the light," or "must have been a chance." It's happening all the time.
Well, I guess that's kind of what I was getting at. Is it because we're more open to that experience in that moment of trauma, that we're actually intrinsically aware that we have angels around us, and even though we might not, you know, consciously be calling out for the help, that we unconsciously are striving to continue life, and that is when the angels are able to interact with us. That's kind of what I was wondering, because it seems to me like, by and large, people walk through lives and will never know that they've encountered an angel. And I'm not saying that they don't. I mean, I always think of that. You never know when you're entertaining angels.
Right.
That always is something that is always kind of in the back of my mind.
Sure. Good to remember.
But I just kind of curious how it is for people who aren't, you know, engaged and act like yourself in that constant contact, how it does happen when we're not, because how we kind of allow that to kind of manifest, or how that mechanism works for us out there who aren't in that constant contact.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, when one's in a desperate situation, you know, everything sort of, you know, everything that's irrelevant drops away. And I think, I completely agree. I think we are more open at that point, you know. And probably, as they say, you know, there aren't many atheists in foxholes. When you're in that state, you're kind of open to grasp onto whatever's out there. And, of course, there's a great deal out there that we're not aware of, in a conscious way, in an everyday way. I'm not in any way saying that the way I live my life is the way other people should or need to live their life. Not at all. I'm just on a journey of personal discovery. I never really intended to publish these books. It was only when I completed one of them, friend read them, part of the publishing company, and said, yes, they were interested. You know, I thought they were far too personal, but apparently they're touching people's hearts in some way.
Well, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, these are very, and for a lot of people out there, these are very personal. I mean, specifically, this one is probably the most kind of personal book that out of the series that I've read, because I mean, it really delves into your own personal history more than, you know, how you're prior to meeting Georgia, and you know how you were kind of prepared for being able to kind of have this communication and this relationship with the angels that have been involved in your life. We're at the point for a break here. We're talking with Timothy Wiley. Links are up at granddarkconspiracy.com. You can link up to his website there. Also, you can link up to the book, which is Rebel Angels and Exiles, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the Spiritual Quickening of Humanity. You can link up to that, get yourself a copy. I would encourage you to do so. And when we come back from the break, we'll continue the conversation with Timothy on the other side. We will be right back.
Hey.
Yeah, we're on break.
This is Ian.
And I'm Doc.
You can listen to us every weekday morning from 6 until 9.
Right here on True Oldies QT 1270.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going to want to take a
left. You are not going to.
Then what you're
going to
do is turn onto Marcy Avenue.
Just broke up.
And go past the first three lights and then take the next left. I don't really think she's happy,
but who am I to judge, right?
Park on the right. That's what I heard last night.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once. Like texting and driving.
Stop the text.
Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
8. I deliver your Sunday paper every week.
7. We work on the same floor.
1 in 8 Americans is struggling with hunger.
6. Our kids walk to school together every day.
Including millions of children and seniors.
5. We chat in the elevator at work sometimes.
4. I'm your cashier at the grocery store.
Who's the 1 in 8 in your life that needs help? You can make a difference through Feeding America at feedingamerica.org/1in8. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
I have a passion for the environment. That's why I serve in the United States Coast Guard. We monitor commercial vessels, making sure our ports and waterways are safe and clean from oil or other hazardous material. We patrol our fisheries, protect marine wildlife and their habitats. With all we do, it's about protecting America.
Were you born ready to protect America? Learn more at GoCoastGuard.com.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard in cooperation with the Ohio Association of Broadcasters and this station.
My name is Tom Thornton.
And my name is Cindy Thornton. We're retired, and this is how we live United.
We decided to volunteer with United Way at our community free health clinic.
United Way is how we contribute, because we know our time and money are going to the right places.
Judging by the thank yous we get at the clinic, I'd say we're doing the right thing with our retirement, too. We're Tom and Cindy Thornton. We volunteer at our community free health clinic. We don't just wear the shirt.
We live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
The Ohio Child Support Enforcement Agencies wish to thank employers for their contribution to Ohio's child support program. Did you know that each year, employers collect nearly $1.4 billion in child support payments? We recognize that employers are key to the child support program's success. Brought to you by the Ohio CSEA Directors Association. Visit us on the web at ocda.us for more information. The support of our partners is key.
Far from the city, where the Lorax roams free, is the home of the magical truffula trees. In a place you will love, with things you'll adore us, it's a magical spot. We call it the forest.
Everyone here needs the trees.
And who are you?
I'm the Lorax, guardian of the forest.
The forest is there for you to explore. So come once to see it, then come back lots more.
I just like hearing you say it.
Visit discovertheforest.org, brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
After thousands of years, after crippling millions of children, polio will soon be stopped forever. All over the world, people are joining the men and women of Rotary to end polio now. People like Jackie Chan and Jane Goodall.
We are this close.
This close.
People like Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
This close.
People like you. Be a part of history. Help Rotary end polio now at rotary.org/endpolio. We are this close.
From True Oldies 1270 WQTT, here is your Marysville area weather bug forecast. For the rest of the morning, there's a chance of freezing rain and sleet. It'll be cloudy, a low 32. No accumulations are expected. We'll have rain Friday afternoon as we wrap up the week with a high 42. Rain continues Friday night with a low of around 40. We'll have more rain Saturday morning. Our afternoon high should be 41 with winds over 15 miles an hour. Sunday as we wrap up the weekend, we'll have a mostly sunny day. Our high 41. For True Oldies 1270, I'm Rod Tanner.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps a Georgia on my mind.
And we're back. You're listening to The Grand Dark Conspiracy on WQTT 1270 AM, streaming online at qt1270.com. We've got Timothy Wiley on the air with us. We're talking Rebel Angels and Exiles, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the Spiritual Quickening of Humanity. Links are up at grandarkconspiracy.com for you to click on through, get yourself a copy of the book. And also, if you're interested in a lot of Timothy's other works, which he has a lot of other books, and also he's a very accomplished artist. You can check him out at TimothyWiley.com. Of course, links are on our homepage there as well. So, Timothy, what is fascinating here is, you know, we're talking about angels, and I don't think that a lot of people even understand what an angel is and how it interacts with us and what their roles are in the universe. With Georgia, the one that is writing with you these books, self-described as a watcher, and I don't know if you could kind of explain what that is and how that – what the part that they play in the multiverse.
Well, there's a lot of questions in there. Well, let's start with an analogy. The electromagnetic spectrum, we all know about that, right? We've got the visible light area, you know, which is a relatively small area. Then we have the infrareds and the ultraviolets and everything like that, which we basically not aware of, although they do, of course, have effects on us. I would say that the sort of sentient intelligence, put it that way, you know, which starts with rocks that have a level of sentience, very, very long, slow level of sentience, raised up to the plant kingdom, second chakra, which has a more, you know, kind of like more immediate, more sexy, more, you know, more responsive. But it doesn't move around much. You know? Plants don't move around much. Some do, most don't. Next we get the animals, you know, the third chakra, the animals. And we get a higher degree of mobility. We get more choices. We get more more things we have, you know, animals have to confront. They have to kind of grow up. They have to learn. They have to understand. And, of course, then we get to the sort of the higher levels of the apes and then, of course, the dolphins and human beings. Now, you know, that's merely our carcass, if you like. It's just our physical vehicle. Our spirits, of course, come from somewhere else, and it's our spirits that inhabit our bodies, if you like. And it's obviously when our bodies die, spirits move along, and we move to another reality in which we're given another body, you know, which is appropriate to that particular reality. Now, within that sort of grand scale of sentience, if you like, we get human beings, you know, or mortals, more likely, you know, because mortal beings basically are common on all third dimensional planets, if you like, or third. And then, if we go back to the chakra system, which I was echoing up, the fourth chakra is, you know, the heart, obviously. The fifth chakra, the chakra in the throat, is the chakra of the angels. Right? It's a slightly higher vibrational level. Go back to the electromagnetic spectrum, get the understanding that there are these wavelengths that have effects on us that we can, you know, pick up with various different machineries like radios and televisions. And the angels, of course, metaphorically occupy a higher level of vibration than the vibrations that were. Basically, our bodies are created to be able to deal with, right? Now, angels are a long way above us. They cannot interact with us. Right? When people say angels making, you know, babies with humans, no, not possible. Doesn't happen, right? Angels are too high up in this dimensional thing. Now, there are angels which are much closer to us, right? Which are fairly local, called midway creatures. They can interact with us. They don't have sex with us, but they can haul us out of crashing cars, for instance. They can manifest and then demanifest. And they're basically kind of the basic planetary citizens, if you like, because they've been here a lot longer than we have, in continuous lives. They live a mortal life, just as angels live a mortal life. Now, the universe is enormous, right? And then that goes without saying. We're just starting to discover just how enormous it is. But it's not only enormous, it's very, very well organized. It's organized for beings, right? Planets are made for people, not people for planets.
Right.
That's how it's organized. And it's organized from the inner levels, right? The levels of the angels that we can contact through our imaginations. And the outer levels, which we experience, you know, as 3D reality, that's the level that we can see and understand. Extraterrestrials also live on the outer levels. Now, obviously, extraterrestrials have angels too. You know, they're also guided by angels, to the extent they're aware of it or not. Obviously, it depends on their consciousness. Obviously, as I say, most of the extraterrestrials I've come across are perfectly well aware of the angelic realms.
So, I mean, we begin to kind of see that there's a structure in place, and we are only aware of a lot. We are only aware of a small, I don't want to say a lot, a small amount of a structure that is a lot bigger than we can sense with the senses we've been given in these bodies.
Precisely. You know, I mean, you can look, for instance, at an ant sensorium is trained very precisely, you know, to what an ant needs and what it does in its life. One can stand over an ant and it's completely unaware of us, because it's about its business and it's not really trained and focused. You know, but if we start stamping around, of course, then it can be aware of us.
So, we are talking about beings that are much more enlightened to how the universe itself works and are much more integral in making it work.
I think that probably more familiar rather than more enlightened. My experience with angels is that they're much more similar to us than we would probably understand, and there's a good reason for that, because they have to understand us. If they were ridiculously different from us, they would have no way of understanding us, just as I'm sure there are extraterrestrials who have no idea, you know, we just consider us as animals. But angels are very different. You see, what the magic of it really is that the angels see the inner God within us, the Atman, the inner spark. That's who they're really serving. Although that may be a little humiliating for an egotistical human being to think that the angels aren't serving them, they're serving the God within them. Whether they're aware of that God within them or not is kind of irrelevant. That's really who the angels are serving. Of course, they love us too, because, you know, the God is within us. But that's really a dance, you know, that continues, you know, after we die and on our multiverse adventure, if you know, which is a very long and very, very wonderful adventure.
Well, I mean, that is something that I think that a lot of people would look at, talking about the kind of divine spark that's within us. That is something that is in a lot of different religious traditions, and it's something that, I mean, it has been talked about at great length. So it makes sense that if... And this is something, we've got to take a real quick break here, Timothy, for station identification. Sure. I want to get to this right after we do that. Hold on just one second.
Sure. WQTT Marysville. News, sports, weather, and great oldies all day long. Lock it on. True Oldies, QT 1270.
All right, that's our station identification. One of the things that I wanted to get to, and I didn't want to kind of break it up, was we're looking at this this divine spark within this us having this divine spark. I mean, it is something that is, you know, I know with the Gnosticism and things like that, it is something that a lot of traditions hold, that we hold a divine spark. And if if you think about, you know, the angels and then and we hold a divine spark, then that speaks to the angels serving that. That speaks to there being an origin point for that divine spark. So, you know, if we're emanating that divinity, and then the angels are serving it, what is the source of that divinity?
That specific is essentially God the Father. It's the primary aspect of the Godhead that has, I wouldn't say split itself, because the process is completely unimaginable. How it's done, I don't think, certainly. From what I know, angels don't understand it either. Because, you see, in a sense, we're at the, on one of the lowest aspects of the sentient well that is able to contain this this godness, if you like. Because obviously beneath us, putting it on that particular scale, the animals are not indwelled by this god. And indeed, the angels aren't indwelled by this god either. Which is one of the things that makes it so fascinating for them. Because, of course, we act in all sorts of very ungodly ways, which I think probably is a great deal of puzzlement to them. But it is a process, and it's a process, of course, that many religions and many belief systems have considered, more towards the sort of the sacred belief systems, the more esoteric ones, because it's easier to control from a religious engineering point of view. It's far easier to control a group of people by telling them God is up there somewhere, and he's going to punish you, sees everything. But the more enlightened aspects of the religions will pretty much always tell you that God is actually indwells you, which is a very important point to start from, actually.
It is a very important part to start from, and I think, you know, it's funny. It's one of those things where I think a lot of people get wrapped up in religions. And I'm going to just go and say it outright. I mean, I'm not going to try to walk around this. But, you know, a lot of people who engage in Christianity never really kind of grasp that aspect of Christianity. They just think about the, like you said, the God up there looking down there, kind of like Santa Claus does, with his checklist of seeing who's naughty and nice. And they miss out on the aspect that it tells us that, you know, if you're accepting and worshiping of God, Father, in the Christian perspective.
I think it's a process. You know, just as when we're children, you know, we tend to see the authority figures of our parents outside ourselves.
Right.
But then as we sort of come of age, you know, when we're sort of 13 or 14, you know, we start sort of owning ourselves and realizing, no, hey, we're responsible for our actions. We don't have to look to our parents. And I think it's rather similar to that on a sort of macro scale. And, you know, religion sort of, you know, they build themselves up, you know. And obviously to be a popular religion, you know, or to be a widely sung religion, you've got to influence a great many people. And by telling them that God lives inside them doesn't really help much.
Well, it doesn't help grow the business of religion, I guess is one way to put
yeah.
it. But what I was saying is, like, I mean, I think a lot of Christians do miss that part in the actual religion itself, maybe not in the pews, but where it teaches us that, you know, if you accept God as, you know, as your master, I guess, to some degree, as your God, I guess, worthy to be worshipped, that you are given an indwelling spirit within yourself. So, I mean, and it is one of those things that I think a lot of people miss, that, you know, we're told that if you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior, that you will have the Holy Spirit within you. And that's an aspect of God. And, I mean, that's something that a lot of people like to kind of gloss over and don't like to consider, that there is a divine spark placed within us.
Yes.
And it is in most, like you said, of the more esoteric, you know, religious traditions.
Yes.
And I do agree. Like, the business of religion sometimes gets in the way of the actual principles that will help us improve our lives. And like you said, and that is something that when you start dealing with the ideas of faith and religion, that we do grow. I mean, if we choose one of those avenues, we do grow in that faith. And like you said, we go from being, you know, looking at our parents as the authority figures and the controlling factors in our life, to realizing that we're the ones that are basically responsible for what happens in our lives.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, you can see it in the political system as well. You know, a political system which insists on, you know, telling everybody what's right and what's wrong, and a political system that tells everybody, make up your own mind about what's right and wrong, and learn from the experience. I mean, you know, it is very much part of a growth, you know, a growth process, and it happens, I think, on every level and in every aspect of our lives. You know,
and this is where I'm going to bring it back to the book. This is something that I found in the book with yourself in relations to kind of looking at this very deeply personal story about your journey and discovering and moving to the point to where you are now. I mean, you started off in a very different place than where you are now. But that place where you started off, and we kind of talked about this a little bit during the break, was you know, where you started off kind of did, in some way, help inform you into where you ended up.
Oh, absolutely. And, I don't think I'm strange in this, but when I look back of my life, as I have been doing, obviously, through the process of the book, I can't think of one experience I've had, however dreadful that I have, a dreadful experience, that hasn't ultimately been helpful and useful and valuable and insightful. And I wouldn't have swapped it for the world. I wouldn't like to go through it again, but I certainly wouldn't have swapped it for the world. So I think that, you know, we do, whether we know it or not, we're being sort of licked into shape. And I think, you know, I think sometimes about these professional atheists and, you know, the rap that, oh, you know, and I did it too, you know, when I was 10 or 11 years old and being carted off to these dreadful church services in England. And thinking, my God, this is bunkum, this is rubbish, you know. What on earth? You know, and I became an absolutely arrant atheist, obviously, because I was too young and too immature and too stupid to realize that you have to separate religion and spirituality. The spiritual is very different. Religion is really, you know, it's kind of socialized spirituality, if you like. It's a very different thing. You know, so I actually had to put myself in a situation where I was so atheistic that I would go into sort of spiritual meetings and break them up by asking questions which were so crackingly logical that the poor person who was giving the lecture on him couldn't answer them. And, you know, I had to be really heavily whacked over the head, which I was. And I had a situation, you know, a series of situations, using the entheogen lysergic acid at that point. And I had, this was before all that went illegal back in the late 50s, and I had a series of experiences in which I had encounters with the Godhead. Not completely unusual, if you like, with a really good acid. But it was incontrovertible. I admit God. I could never deny that. I could never go back on that. So I kind of went from being this extreme atheist, which actually I rather advise. If somebody really wants to get in contact with God, being an atheist is probably the best way of doing it. God comes along and says, how dare you? Dashes you in front of the head. Wake up, boy. And, you know, that was very firmly in place, you know, by the time I was 23, I think, probably. And so I went through a lot of other things after that, but that's never left me.
Well, it's interesting. You know, one of the things that when we were talking about atheism, there's a difference, there's a distinction that I will make between an atheist and an anti-theist. atheist? Because I think that an atheist is somebody that goes through life and doesn't believe in God, and there's no proselytization. You know, there's not, the, like you said, that professional atheism. An anti-theist will proselytize and attack other people who do believe in something more. So I do make kind of a distinction there.
Thank you. I haven't heard that. I appreciate that. Thank you.
The idea to me of there not being a creator or some sort of supreme being out there, I really struggle with having that thought, because it doesn't seem to make sense to me at all. It really doesn't. Because even if we were to kind of, create life to prove that, you know, this is how evolution works without God, that's fine, but we still have a creator to prove that. You see what I'm saying? Like, if we were to replicate that process, then we replicated that process, and there was a creator behind it. And that's just logically where I end up saying that, you know, this started somewhere. I think that's incontrovertible. That's just me, you know.
Well, no, I think you make a fascinating point, because in a sense, you know, when you do know, it's so blindingly obvious. It's just incredible, isn't it? What you can go around saying, it doesn't exist. I think in part, again, it's looking for sort of, scientific materialism, you know, the general sort of scientific sort of zeitgeist. And that falls on what I consider, you know, making the mistakes again and again and again, until you finally have to confront the fact that it doesn't hold together. That has to be something deeper, something more, some organizing principle beyond our understanding. And it's sort of almost a compulsion to have to deny that and to have to see, well, you know, can we understand it? You know, how would we do it? All that sort of stuff, which is just sort of absolute bunkum.
Well, that is something that is kind of bonkers for myself, that to look at and to say that we need to be able to understand how these things will work, and how if the system doesn't make sense to us, that it can't possibly be organized in any sense of the matter. Basically saying that there can't be a design if we don't understand it. I mean, that smacks of a such arrogance, and it just drives me nuts. I don't understand that thought process, because when we look at God, or we look at creation, or we look at the universe at large, we look at it as if God exists, he has to think like we do, and that doesn't make any sense to me, because we don't see everything in the universe. We don't understand everything in the universe. We are the goldfish in the bowl looking out.
We're not even sure that, you know, what's happening around us, you know, most of the time. Absolutely.
So, I mean, it is one of those things that's absolutely maddening to myself, and I wish.
Well, can I pour some salve on that? One of the things that extraterrestrials always go on about with astonishment is the incredible difference that they find on this planet, the difference of consciousness. How there are some people who are extraordinarily developed and mature and wise, and there are some people who are absolutely not mature and not wise in the very slightest bit. And a great many sort of intermediary, you know, because on those planets, I mean, if you can get your stuff together enough to be able to get off the planet and be allowed to kind of get into space and go and visit other planets, you're pretty well organized. You're not a mass of conflicting people,
right,
organizations. You know, you've got your planetary stuff together. So I think that's probably the viewpoint that we have to adopt. it's not so much sort of a sort of superior viewpoint, although, you know, poor little people, they don't know what they're doing, but more that the incredible range, and everybody is dancing as fast as they can, even if they, you know, whether they know it or not. And everybody's on a spiritual journey, whether they know it or not. And they'll discover that when they die. My goodness, they will.
Well, you know, that is the thing. If everyone's on a spiritual journey, we can talk about all these opposing viewpoints, like you said, but in reality, that is part of their spirituality. There's no denying it. Even if you're an atheist, guess what? That atheist philosophy that you've adopted, that's your spirituality. You can't avoid it. That's another thing that I do kind of take a little bit of glee in for myself, to say.
Well, think about it this way, that an atheist will get the most wonderful surprise when they die.
Yes, they will. Yes, they will. You know, and there's something waiting for all of us, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Some things not quite as pleasant as others. I mean, there are zones, after-death zones, called compensatory zones, where one has the chance to experience either what one hasn't had the chance to experience in this life, or be on the other end of rather unpleasant experiences, which one has doled out in this life, in order to have to understand what it feels like, you know, to be on the other end of cruelty and self-serving brutality and stuff like that. So, you know, these are the hell zones, and they're pretty unpleasant. But they are, of course, passable through. You go through them, you know, for eternity on something stupid like that. You know, it's all part of the learning. It's a teaching machine, basically. It's like called a university, or multiversity.
So, yeah, that's something I don't quite get, the kind of eternity in hell, where that even comes from, other than, I mean, at least I don't see it in any kind of source text, at least in the Judeo-Christian traditions. It's not in the source text, but somehow that has really kind of creeped into our consciousness, that hell is eternal if it exists.
I mean, it's basically priestcraft. You know, it's much more terrifying. You know, say you've got to behave yourself or you're going to go to hell for all eternity. I mean, you just have to look at the person and say, you must be crazy. What do you mean all eternity? I thought that God would want me to do that. Would want that for me. You know? Where is children, for heaven's sake?
Well, and that's just it. You know, we're his children. There's going to be some. Well, I don't want to get too preachy. There's going to be a chance for redemption. I will say that. You know, and that's the kind of the path that we're all on. Like you've said before, is that we're all on a path of redemption. That even includes the angels that were in rebellion against the Godhead.
Exactly. And now we come to, of course, a very interesting point, and that is those angels that rebelled with the Bible says the third of heaven, I think. Wasn't quite as many as that, but there's certainly many, probably many billions, actually. Certainly many hundreds of thousands. That they are being given the opportunity to join the human or the mortal line by entering mortal incarnation. In other words, to become human beings, if you like. And to, you know, live out their lives on a planet that is kind of the outflowing of the decisions that they made 200,000 years ago.
So the opportunity for them, and if I'm understanding this correctly, and this is kind of a very intriguing thought, just to even start with, the opportunity for them is then to give up their angelic nature and become human, and then by their humanity, that's their saving grace. That's their opportunity to receive grace and redemption.
It's the start of quite a long process, yes. It does take a lot of incarnations to be able to go all the way through it. But yes, it is the start. And of course, you know, by joining the human line, they become indwelt by the God in a way that angels weren't indwelt, you see. So actually, It's a promotion in a curious kind of way. Angels are created for their roles, and they stay in their roles for many millions of years, right? Quite happily doing their thing. Right? We're the upstarts. We're the ones who move upwards. We're the ones who actually go all the way up, to the Godhead. And this is something, very, I wouldn't say enviable, because I don't like to think of angels envying us. But I think they probably did something about that. I think probably quite a lot of the sort of subtext to the Lucifer Rebellion was based on a kind of jealousness, or, what on earth are you spending all this time messing around with these monkeys, this sort of thing. So, joining the human line is really quite a thing. Now, one of the things is, of course, they don't know that they've been angels, right? Most of them, I should say, speak very openly, most of us, right, generally have very difficult childhoods. And that's because we have to develop our emotional bodies, because coming in as angels, angels have very weak emotional bodies. You don't need a strong emotional body, you don't have a lot of choices. But we have freedom of choice, and we have to have strong emotional bodies. So a lot of these, and George is telling me now, something like 120 million of us are now down here, and we're living our lives as human beings, and, some of us are becoming aware of who we are or who we've been. Some of us are sort of living rather naughty lives in order to experience all the aspects of being human. Some of us are able to move through the naughtiness and come out the other side. I'd like to hope that's where I've reached. Out the other side of the darkness.
So, at least for what you've been told, what is the end game? And this is just how I wired. I always want to know what the end game is for us. Do we have that? We reincarnate, we come back, and we learn lessons. If I'm understanding this correctly, we learn lessons. What happens when we've learned what we've needed to learn, and we don't have to come back and learn lessons?
Well, then we all right. There's a very subtle distinction here, right? Basically, most people on the planet, right, are what we would call first-timers. In other words, their souls are created here at this incarnation, if you like. They begin their lives here, and from then on, they go on for eternal lives. They rise up through the ascension line, if you like. Angels coming into mortal incarnation, the first time they come in, they can't move up, right? And they have to go through a lifetime, and then they get reincarnated again and again. I think, speaking personally, I didn't count them, but I think at least sort of 300 or 400 of these damn things. And also on a series of different planets as well, not just on this planet. But then when we come to a certain point, and I've known intuitively all my life, this is my last incarnation, and I'm sure there are a lot of us who also have that experience. This is the last time I have to do this thing. So now, having joined the human line, I can now sort of move up through the various different levels. And there are many, many, many levels. They're kind of like lifetimes, if you like, but you don't die. You just move on to another level. And all these are learning experiences in this great sort of multiversity of ours, until we become sort of so open that we can float out of this universe into the universe behind the universe, the central universe, where the Godheads exist in that state. This is all very sort of, practical, empiric, down-to-earth stuff. It's not, airy-fairy stuff. It's really all quite practical.
Well, one of the things that I always struggle with for reincarnation for myself is, and maybe this, I just don't want to come back. Once is enough for me, and maybe it maybe I have reincarnated a 8,000 times. I don't know, but when I look at it now, it's like I really don't want to struggle through this all again. Not that I don't feel blessed and had a life that I think was worth living. It's just I also feel the weight of the years, if you know what I mean. And, boy, I don't want to go through the struggle again. So that's one of those things where I'm really rooting for all the possible afterlives that I've entertained the thought of. It's like the least appealing one to me out of all of them. You know, having to come back and do it over and over again, just to me, that would be hell. And maybe that is, my punishment. Who knows? Maybe I was a really bad, naughty boy, your girl. The previous incarnation. But that being said, it's not like I don't feel blessed that I've had the opportunity to live the life that I've lived, but at the same time I do feel the full weight of the years on me. It's one of those things like, out of all of them, whether it's oblivion or just going to heaven and staying in heaven or this and that, that is the least appealing one, is to continually come back, and so
I think from the work you're doing, and the way you understand things, I think you're probably okay.
Good Lord, I hope so, because
what you see, the thing about previous incarnations is that they're really irrelevant, basically, because we are the sum of all our the sum of all we've learned and all we haven't learned. The only reason that they're relevant is if something that I was undealt with in my previous incarnation, the most immediate one. I had a series of situations where I was very badly handled and very badly dealt with, and I ended up committing suicide. So I had to, in this lifetime, without knowing it, right, I had to have the situation replayed. Fortunately, not quite as dreadful as it was in the previous incarnation, but I was able to deal with it in this incarnation. I was able to actually, deal with it. I write about it in my books. It's probably a little too personal to go into on the radio, but it's in the books. And by the way, you talked about the personal thing. I learned very early when I was writing my books, back in the early 80s, that if they were going to be any value to anybody else, right, then I had to tell the truth. And Georgia is even more than I am. I mean, she's desperately truthful. I've made this pledge for her that, go for it, girl, if that's what you saw, let me know. I need to know it. So it's actually, of course, it's a fascinating experience to understand all the things that went on in one's life behind one's back, what people were saying, what the impact of things that, why did that happen to happen? It's like, okay, now I understand.
That would be quite illuminating, and I kind of want to get into that. We do have to take another break here, Timothy, but I do want to get into that, talking about getting to see that perspective of your life while you're still living, because that is one of the things that a lot of people don't get to see, how it affects other people and how other people are viewing you at a certain time. And that is something that would be endlessly fascinating, I think, for a lot of people, and equally horrifying at the same time. And I definitely want to kind of get into that, having that experience in having that related to you. We're talking with Timothy Wiley, and you can link up to his website at grandarconspiracy.com, as well as link up to the book Rebel Angels and Exiles. In exile. I keep wanting to add the Ness on there. I don't know why I want to do that. Rebel Angels in Exile, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the Spiritual Quickening of Humanity. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break. And while we're doing that, you can all go out to GrandDarkConspiracy.com and buy yourself a copy of the book. We're going to be right back.
This is Dan Hoard, voice of the Cincinnati Bengals, and you're listening to True Oldies QT 1270, the home of the Bengals in Central Ohio.
Maybe it's time to take a fresh look at everything we thought we knew about landing a great job. For instance, perhaps great careers start at the middle school science fair instead of at the job fair. Because the fact is, the jobs of the future will be heavily geared towards science, technology, engineering, and math. In other words, STEM. So if you're a student, talk to your school counselor about STEM. If you're a parent, talk to your kids. A public service message from America's Navy.
On my first patrol, my adrenaline was pumping.
Always on high alert. After a while, it takes a toll. I was counting the days till I came home to my family. Finally, a day arrived.
But then I realized things were different.
I had trouble focusing and relating to things the way I used to. I decided to reach out.
Once I started making connections, things began to turn around.
Find resources and support at maketheconnection.net.
Make the connection.
At 4:15 p.m. at an office in Michigan, Angie Hicks is not at her desk. She's giving blood at the company blood drive.
At the same time in the same office, Kevin Meehan is not at his desk. He's at the doctor. Kevin has cancer and needs another round of chemo.
Kevin will need blood to fight his cancer.
Angie's blood will help him win.
When you give blood to the American Red Cross, you change a life.
Starting with your own.
Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to schedule your appointment to give blood.
Wondering how you can learn about computers and how the internet can improve your daily life? The world's a lot larger with broadband. The Every Citizen Online program offers free local training. Learn how to use broadband service at your local library. It's faster than dial-up. It's easier than you think. Call 1-855-NOW-I-CAN to enroll. Get connected. Life is better with broadband.
Sponsored by Connect Ohio and aired by the OAB and this station.
Ranger Station.
Hi, I want to report a bear sighting.
Location?
My front door. It was Smokey Bear. My husband was burning leaves in the yard. He just came inside for a second.
Never leave a fire unattended. If it's too hot to touch, it's too hot to leave.
Smokey said that too.
We go way back. I knew him when he was just a cub.
How cute.
If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
So when you get to the corner of Smith and Orchard, you're going
to
want to take a
you
left.
You are not going to
then what you're
going
to do is turn onto Martin
and Brad just broke up
and go past
and
the apparently first three
she's
lights and then take
it.
The next left.
I don't really
then
think she's
more
happy,
blocks,
but
and you should be
who
there.
Am I to judge, right?
Park
anyway,
on the right.
That's
I'll
what
see
I
you
heard
later
last
tonight.
Night.
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text. Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
From True Oldies 1270 WQTT, here is your Marysville area weather bug forecast. For the rest of the morning, there's a chance of freezing rain and sleet. It'll be cloudy, low 32. No accumulations are expected. We'll have rain Friday afternoon as we wrap up the week with a high 42. Rain continues Friday night with a low of around 40. We'll have more rain Saturday morning. Our afternoon high should be 41 with winds over 15 miles an hour. Sunday as we wrap up the weekend, we'll have a mostly sunny day. Our high 41. For True Oldies 1270, I'm Rod Tanner.
Skies are full.
And we're back. You're listening to the Grand Dark Conspiracy on WQTT 1270 AM, streaming online at QTT1270.com. We've got Timothy Wiley on the line with us. We've been discussing his book, Rebel Angels in Exile, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the Spiritual Quickening of Humanity. One of the things we've touched on a lot in this discussion is the personal nature that of yourself related in this book, and having that chance and opportunity to see your life unfold from a perspective that most people wouldn't get to see. Like I said before we went to break, would be endlessly fascinating and horrifying all at the same time, because as you relate in the book, you begin to see something that you didn't see before was people's core attitudes about you. Yeah. and the experiences that you were having with them, that you wouldn't have had that perspective at the time going through it.
No, not at all. Not at all. Now, I'm thinking of an example, and one rather distasteful one. I recall I was in English public school, and a private school, and one of those sort of very uppity ones, in an era where it was really punishing to be there. I mean, I don't think anybody emerged from a British public school without, you know, being really sort of bent out of shape by it. But anyway, I left fairly early because I couldn't sort of bear to sort of stay on. But at a certain point, I think probably when I was about 16 or 15 and a half, the two young lads who had come to the school in the same year as I had, in the same term as I had, that's how it works, they'd become your kind of three best friends, if you like. And you kind of move up, you know, through the classes. But anyway, at a certain point, we were called in by a housemaster, and we were accused of, you know, having homosexual relationships with each other. That's the last thing we had. We were friends, but good God, it's the last thing. And he would not, of course he denied it, he would not accept it, and he beat us, of course, as they always do, and sent us off. And it worried me for years. I think, why on earth did they think of us like that? You know, it's just completely out of the blue. And of course, what I discovered through George's work is that I had made an enemy who had risen above me in the hierarchy and who had made up this story in order to get me into trouble. I had no idea that was going on. Now, that's just one of 100 things that I learned that were going on, that either sort of, you know, blessed me or cursed me. And it was very interesting and very, a very good thing to be able to unwind from that, because that particular man now sits in the House of Lords. Little ass.
So, I mean, to me, you know, I don't know how it is for everybody. I don't know how to put this. I am keenly aware of whether people are masking feelings about me or not. I don't know how to even, like, couch this or for myself. I am aware that of when people are doing things like that, working behind, behind. I don't know why or how, but I am aware of that. And it is something that, you know, if I really don't want it to happen, I will kind of put myself in self-denial, but still kind of consciously know that. And I don't know why that is. I just think that I am really observant emotionally, I guess.
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if it's an aspect of empathy. I mean, empathy is like a muscle, really, like a lot of these things. It's a muscle. And the more one practices it, and it's difficult. Empathy has its downside as well, because it's very close to sympathy. And, of course, if one goes into sympathy with somebody, in other words, one identifies with their pain and thinks how dreadful it would be to be in that pain. Oh, what would they like? You know, give them a pat on the back or whatever it is. Empathy feels what the other person is feeling. Doesn't think, oh my goodness, how terrible if I felt that, right? That's going into sympathy. They see more accurately what that other person needs. It might not be a pat on the back. It might be, you know, a kick in the bottom. or it might be another sort of treatment, which isn't simply a sort of placating treatment that comes with sympathy. So I think that we're all sort of learning to be empathic, more and more empathic with each other, and we could see what happens when we're not empathic with each other, as we've been seeing recently with these situations with the police,
Right.
Obviously, clearly not empathic with the people they shoot. In fact, they're not at all. I mean, they're so frightened that they project their fear onto other people, of course, and they think other people are as dangerous as they are.
Well, that's the thing, and it's created a circle, because I think the people reacting to what happened, what transpired, also are feeding back into that. They're not having the empathy to put themselves in the situation that the officers are in. They're doing so. It builds.
Yes.
And empathy is something that when I look at it, I guess that is the word. I struggle with other people not having that empathy, meaning that how. I struggle with seeing other people and not getting that empathy back.
It simply means they haven't suffered enough. That's all.
Well, I guess that's the case. But I mean, when you had the opportunity to kind of look at your past through George's eyes, I think of that as one of those things. I'm reading this, and I'm like, this would be a gift in a way. Something that not a lot of people would have the opportunity to kind of experience, to kind of understand your impact on the world around you, and even further down the line on that, and to see the influence, the impact, and the overall effect of the choices and decisions you made on people that you weren't even aware of. I mean, to me, that's a gift. It's scary. It's a scary one. It's not one that, it's not a box that a lot of people would be willing to open, but it is definitely a gift.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess an architect building a building is a gift, isn't it?
Yes.
To people. So I think any creative act, and of course, just being a human being is a creative act. I mean, we are literally, in a sense, co-creating our reality. We're forming our reality. We're inviting into our reality what we need in order to learn. And sometimes what we need to learn is, rather a hard lesson. And sometimes what we need to learn is quite delightful. And we magnetize delightful people into our lives.
We do, and there was one, I wish I could remember his name, but there was a character that you had to deal with, and it was a real person that I thought was very interesting, because it seemed like you guys, I can't remember his name, when you were working with the process, I think you went to Italy, and...
Ah, yes, right.
And you were with quite a mercurial fellow. I found that whole journey that you had there was really intriguing, and I figure that's one of those times where you were put to the test in life, because it seemed like there was an opposition there, even though you're working towards a similar goal. I can't remember the gentleman's name.
A woman, one of the women in the mystery school, and we went on this trip all the way down through Europe. We're actually sort of following a biblical process, basically, because we had no money, and we would just preach the word, what we believed to be true, which was that love your enemies was essential to that particular idea at that particular point. And we would be, put up by people and taken care of by people. Anyway, we got to a point, I think, in southern Italy, I think, one of the islands down there, and we were having a very fractured relationship. He was somewhat younger than I was, about 10 years younger than I was, and grown up on the sort of the wrong side of the road I think in Southern California, Northern California, very rough lad. and but very clever and intuitive at the same time. Anyway, this actually ended in a situation where, for some reason, he started hitting me. And he hit me in the face, powerfully, and I stood there. I didn't feel any pain. I said, well, go on. Hit me again. Didn't feel any pain. He really flung himself into it. He hit me a third time. And then he started crying. And we kind of broke through at that point. But yeah, I won the test. I don't know quite why I did it. It just felt intuitively the right thing to do. Not to hit him back, but just to let him hit me until he got the point. Seemed right.
But, well, yeah, this Nick was his name. I just, Nick, that's right.
Yeah.
I was like, this is, I mean, the personalities just seemed to clash. Like I said, this guy just seemed like he was kind of rough and tumble. It was from and it's interesting that he kind of ended up in the same spot as you, coming from a very different path. And I mean, I know he probably had his own lessons to learn, but it was interesting to me that you guys ended up together, because it just seemed like it was kind of a disparate personalities.
Very different. We couldn't be more different.
And I mean, it was amazing to me. And I have to ask, because you guys ended up visiting the Abbey in Thelema, and some of the comments that were recorded there, and George's impression of the place was different than what I think what a lot of people would do. And for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with the Abbey of Thelema, that is where Aleister Crowley, tried to get something started in Italy, and he used the Abbey in Thelema for a lot of his rituals and his magical practices. What was your impression of that location?
Oh, it was dreadful. It was an absolute dump. I was expecting something a little random than that, but it's really just a kind of like a hole in the wall. It's very unglamorous, and one of his sort of erotic paintings is on the wall, and it's just about sort of fading off. I saw it 40 years ago. I don't know what sort of state it's in now. But it was a bit bedraggled, rather sad place. And of course, I mean, the whole idea of going down to Sicily and starting a magical cult down there would be absolute madness in Sicily. Absolute madness. Of course, he was kicked out, I think, in a couple of years. Very sensible, too.
Well, I thought that George's impression of the environment as well was pretty telling. Basically, that like it almost had like the life sucked out of it.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you see, the problem with magical systems is it basically it sort of implies that one is dissatisfied. And if one's dissatisfied, then that obviously means that one hasn't got the point. One doesn't understand what's going on. So the very act of being a magician, trying to change the environment, trying to do it, is a kind of self-centered activity. And it is. It does pull the energy out of the place. I mean, it was a very dilapidated, and the locals obviously left it completely alone. They didn't want anything to do with it. It's kind of off the highway, tiny little road, up a sort of half a hill. You have to struggle to get up there. I think we're probably the only people ever go up there. So there weren't any footprints. They were overgrown. And, beaten up, and I think probably perhaps some of the locals had taken bits of it and, built their houses with. Messy place.
So, I mean, that's an interesting point, that magic, being a magical practitioner does imply, really, if you think about it, it's really a truthful statement, dissatisfaction, and trying to kind of change the nature of the world and what it's given you. I've really never considered it in that manner, because I've always looked at, for me, magical practice as that, is kind of self-serving. I've always kind of viewed it that way. But I've always thought that life is something that comes to you. And you know, you're given the power to act and do things within a certain framework, and that's natural to do that, to make the changes through your own power, but not through like these rituals and trying to take the forces that move within the universe to do your bidding, to change the course of nature for you to have something at your own means.
Yes, exactly. It's inevitably self-serving. I mean, even if one's magic is trying to make the world a better place, you know, it's one's own ideas of what is a better place. The essence of God consciousness or cosmic consciousness is the deep understanding that everything is exactly in the right place. Everything is exactly correct. It's all on course. Right? So, you know, there's no need to do any magic. The only thing one needs to do is to heal as you pass by. You know, not to become necessarily involved in trying to sort of rescue people on the other side of the world, because that's generally an extension or an excuse for not really dealing with the anguish one feels inside oneself. I mean, we're far more anguished. We live in this sort of field of fear, this ocean of fear that's been sort of generated, you know, in order to control us. And most of us are far more messed up than we have any idea, which is why we suppress it so firmly and try and get on with our lives. But this particular course that I've taken, and you've taken as well, I think many people are now starting to take, which is a much more spiritual path of self-responsibility and self-understanding. And, of course, the more one understands about oneself, the more one knows about how one reacts and how one, you know, the options that one has in a past situation. And one can see clearly, oh, my goodness, I took the wrong option. Well, what is the right option? And you look at that situation and you kind of review it. And in the end, you kind of end up having basically cleaned up your life. When you've cleaned up your life at that point, I think it becomes much more, you become much more available to the angels, put it that way. You become much more a tool of the angels.
So I have a question then. I mean, in to kind of wrap a little bow around this kind of conversation about, you know, magic and its use, in your estimation, is it better to kind of, instead of do as thou wilt, is thy will be done?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought this had to cut off. I think there's actually a simpler way of looking at it, and that is the magic is really just simply being in the right place at the right time. So how is that achieved? That's achieved by following the natural course of one's feelings and one's impulses and one's loves and one's attractions and one's interests. If one follows these wholeheartedly, you find yourself inevitably, and anybody who reads my books, I'm amazed that I find myself so consistently in an interesting place where something interesting is happening. And I think that's probably the best way of looking at magic. It's not trying to change things. It's just trying to, in a sense, react to them in as sacred a way and as thoughtful a way and as empathic a way as possible.
Well, I guess that's kind of what I'm driving at. I mean, instead of trying to enforce your will on the universe, taking the will of the universe as it comes.
Yes. And the universe is everything. It's all around us. And in my concept of God is a panentheogenic concept, which is that God is inherent in everything, right? Everything, in one form or another. You know, what is not of God, everything is of God. You know, and with that understanding, of course, you know, the universe becomes alive. Everything becomes alive. Everything has life. It's just rocks have a life, but their resonance is so slow that we can't basically pay attention to it. We can't hear it. We're not aware of it.
You just made a statement too, and I guess I didn't want to miss out on the point, but you just made a statement to me that was very striking. If you do the things and you're on the path that you're choosing for yourself, and you find yourself in interesting places, that strikes me kind of to the core, Timothy, because it's one of those things throughout my life I've seen and witnessed a lot of things that, you know, if I sat here and listed them all, people would probably not believe a single word that I say afterwards.
I hope you write them down sometime.
Because I have seen and witnessed a lot of things, a lot of, maybe sometimes they were small things to the grand scale of things, but big things to small people. I don't know how to say that. And other times it's been massive events that I've seen, and just on a whim, I've seen just kind of amazing things. I guess to all the listeners out there, I would suggest that if you're having experiences like that, that means, I guess, you're on a right path.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's in the Exile book that I have that interaction with John Lilly. Timothy Leary.
Yes.
You remember? Now, I mean, that was amazing.
Timothy?
With Leary and with Ginsberg and with, about three or four other of these Illuminati when I was, I was a child. I was 27 or something.
Timothy? Could you pick up from when you said that Timothy Leary, because it just cut out and we had like a high pitched, I don't know, something going on there, but if you could so pick
technology.
Yes.
I found myself at a dinner party, right, where Timothy Leary was at and Ginsberg was at, and about three or four of these kind of Illuminati of that period. And Leary took a particular liking to me. He saw something in me and invited me out to his teepee out in Millbrook. And we spent, I think, about 3 days just simply talking to each other. He was in a situation where he was starting to realize that he'd made a very, very terrible mistake in letting acid go out like that. As opposed to the other viewpoint, which is to let acid filter down through the cognoscenti, which is a far more intelligent way of doing it. And of course, it was a terrible situation that came about. On one level, it was very useful, on another level, of course. But anyway, he felt terrible about it, and he, of course, he had nobody to tell. I wasn't worshipping him or anything like that, I didn't really even admire him. I thought it was rather. I didn't think he was that bright, actually, to tell the truth. And he was actually crippled by his sense of absolutely having to oppose authority, which is something I can recognize. My God, he could not. I mean, he just saw authority and he had to go at it. Anyway, to cut a long story short, that's an example of just being in the right place at the right time. I didn't contrive that situation. It's just something that happened. And it's one of, as you, I've experienced one of many in which I found myself at an absolute key point in somebody's life, because about a month later he was arrested in California for something, his story sort of after that, went, as we know, rather weird.
Yes.
So, I mean, it was actually a very key point in his life. If he had been able to say, "Hey, folk, I made a real mistake. I'm terribly sorry. I should never have put it out like that," he might have been able to sort of pull himself together, not go through that terrible arrest thing he went through.
Timothy, we are at the end. This kind of flew by for me, and
doesn't it?
I always love having the opportunity to speak with you. All the listeners out there, the book is Rebel Angels in Exile, Pleiadians, Watchers, and the Spiritual Quickening of Humanity. I would encourage you to pick this up and get yourself a copy. Links are up at grandarkconspiracy.com. Links are also up to Timothy's website for you to go out and visit. And I would encourage you to do so, because there's a lot more books and that he has written, as well as you get to check out some of his really amazing artwork. And to all the listeners out there, I want to thank you for tuning in. And until tomorrow night, everybody, keep conspiring.